Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the second recap episode of the Ogletree Deacons Global Solutions Podcast. My name is Ethan Isaac. I'm an associate in the cross-border practice group, and I'm joined by...
Hi, my name is Bonnie Puckett. I am a shareholder in the cross-border practice group.
And I'm Carson Burnham, and I'm also a shareholder in the cross-border practice group.
We're here today to talk about where we've come so far with, as you know, this stuff is changing constantly. So we wanted to kind of revisit since our last recap and as well go back to our first six episodes, which covered some really important topics like remote work, which is a question that we're getting literally every day. Carson, mm-hmm. What do you think about the status of cross-border remote work lately?
I think that it turns out that folks really didn't realize that they had so many employees that were able to work from home. And although we've sort of all known in the back of our minds that there are things that you're supposed to do about that, like comply with tax laws and report to various government agencies and so forth, nobody really focused on it until everyone was working from home. And then now that we're at the point that several companies are deciding that they don't need to have people coming back into the office all the time, it's really put a sort of stop in the moment to say, what do we need to do to get ourselves into compliance? And when do we have to do it? And it turns out that we all were supposed to have done it when, Ethan?
Probably back in March when we started doing all these remote works.
Immediately, right. There's essentially no grace period here, except for the few states in the U.S. and countries out there that are trying to invite people to come and work remotely from where they are. But we're not seeing a whole lot of legislation or regulation that's going to give a grace period. All we know is that when there are auditors out there or when there are various ways of trying to invoke local law to the point that it's going to benefit the employee and be a detriment to the company, there's always going to be an argument for the employee on that side. And the company is always going to have to try to rely on equitable arguments.
Right. So this is the thing that constantly gets in the way. So a lot of the risks in connection with cross-border or multi-jurisdictional remote work have to do with, are you being payrolled correctly? Are you submitting the right taxes to the right places? Is tax super complicated? Is it the employer's responsibility? All those things are something that they're very numbersy. On the front end, you can sort of look at tax rates. You can look at what payroll withholding requirements are. What's not so quantifiable up front is what happens if the employee later claims that, French law applies hypothetically to their employment relationship because they happen to be vacationing there for 2.5 years.
Right. And we know that the legislation that's out there will say that it does, because the legislation that's out there was all written and produced far before COVID ever happened. And so when there was going to be any sort of a question about whether a person was working in the jurisdiction that's in question, then you go to the legislation and you find out that, sure, the law where the work is performed is the law that applies. So it seems as though companies have taken a couple of different approaches. I don't know how you guys feel about this, but what I'm seeing is one approach is let's create a bright and fast rule for traveling employees that says that if you have been out of your ordinary jurisdiction for X number of days, X being anything from 15 to 30 to 60 to 180, then you have to report your local jurisdictions' taxes, and you have to be prepared to identify yourself as being an employee who is of that jurisdiction. And then another approach that my clients are taking, at least, is to say, let's find the folks that are definitely coming back, and let's find the folks that definitely aren't, and start from there. So it's much more of a practical approach, knowing that there's a long-term solution to this, and we don't know what the short-term solution is. Have you guys seen anything differently?
I know that I've seen a few clients who have asked for permanent remote work policies, trying to kind of these, I guess, nomad policies where they're allowing employees to work pretty much from anywhere they want, as long as they follow certain restrictions and certain rules.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the best thing that you can do is come up with a policy that's going to apply within your global organization, knowing that you're going to get it wrong in some places and you're going to get it extra right in other places. And, you know, I was thinking about this morning in a different context, and it really comes up in the sort of new sick leave and leave of absence context, where every country went out and said, these folks, this little universe of folks is going to get some kind of protection. And sometimes it's going to be people who are out sick because of COVID. Sometimes it's going to be people who are taking care of a person who is at risk or has COVID. Sometimes it's going to be a person who's in quarantine for reasons they may not even know, but because they've been told they have to be in quarantine. And sometimes it's to take care of their kids. And it's so different in every location. And unlike what we're used to seeing, Bonnie, you want to talk about this a little bit. We usually see trends. We usually know generally how a region is going to handle something, or countries that have very similar civil laws or common laws are going to handle something. We're not seeing a lot of trends here at all. We're really seeing very ad hoc, knowing that it's a, you know, an emergency measure types of decisions. And so for the companies that are trying to handle their employees consistently and fairly, knowing that everyone's got a different deal, what are you guys seeing for solutions there?
It is really tough with the remote work situation, and not only to try to reconcile all of those different things, but also to try to make it possible to administer. As I think, Ethan, you all talked about in your first podcast on remote work, the whole concept of reimbursing or paying for home work expenses is just all over the map. And the only kind of trend or regional prediction you can really of note is the European Framework Agreement, which was from the early 2000s, that put out some guidelines for what employers had to do with respect to the remote workers. And it's actually been very convenient that has already been in place, because the haphazardness of all of this sudden remote work at least has some framework. But as Ethan is pointing out, with these digital nomad type policies, it's not really as simple as just applying that worldwide. And I have several clients who trying to do reimbursements on homework expenses is just unbelievably burdensome. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I'm seeing.
Yeah, that's something that's been the case for the U.S. folks for a long time, where states like California require a company to reimburse for all business expenses and business travel, and states like Texas don't. And so where there needs to be uniform practices and consistencies, companies have had to, for a long time, make a decision about whether they're going to have region specific in the U.S. or state specific policies, or if, on the other hand, they're just going to go with the more generous approach, knowing that no one's going to complain about their generosity. So it's very similar in the global context to what you're seeing in Europe, where it's quite specific that a company has obligations to reimburse for absolutely every business expense. And sometimes, even I remember in Australia very recently, even to have sort of health and safety checks on a remote worker's home office, that a company is sort of in the position of needing to apply an 80-20 rule and figuring out what sort of policy they're going to provide there.
Another interesting point about this kind of haphazard nature of how that things have kind of been thrown together in different countries, and every country has a different way of dealing with this. I think, Carson, you started to mention this a little bit earlier, is that some countries are now encouraging people to come and remote work in their countries, right? I think Bermuda is the one that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, let's go to Bermuda and remote work as a favor to Bermuda, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, where they've now created this work visa where they're encouraging people to come work in Bermuda as kind of like an office away from the office, which I think is a great plan if you can do it. But, you know, for companies, it might be a little more complicated.
I think one of the other things that might be a little more complicated, and it's a bit frustrating about this, is that although the Bermuda Immigration Authority has said, here's this great visa for all of you folks, there's been no sort of corresponding effort on the tax side. So folks could be relocating to Bermuda for any number of reasons. I think one of the great reasons to do it is to park yourself someplace if you have to quarantine, or if you know that you're going to have to travel and you want to travel from a jurisdiction that has not been flagged in a very bad way. But you just don't know what sort of tax implications that's going to have. And as an employer and as the company who's responsible for understanding this stuff, it would make one stop short and hesitate to send everyone to Bermuda.
Many of our Global Solutions series for this reason have focused on remote working. It's a tremendously important issue. We talked about it in our first recap. We talked about it in basically episodes 3 through 5. And we are talking about it again next week with Jean and Mike's podcast on stealth expats. And it's a very interesting subject and one I kind of get worked up about. Then what else do we have to cover in our recap?
You have to tell us about China sexual harassment stuff, Bonnie.
Yes, Ethan, tell us about China sexual harassment stuff.
I think Carson asked you to talk about that.
All right. So let's talk about something else in China first, just because before we leave the remote work topic, China is an area in which the U.S. is too, but there are different payroll situations for different locations. And there has been this practice in China of payrolling people out of Beijing so that they can get certain perks associated with being in Beijing, even when they're not in Beijing. This is a remote work issue that's been going on way before COVID, has nothing specific to do with COVID, but is now just another example of when you're payrolling people from the wrong place, at some point the shoe can really drop on your head and, you know, from a high enough elevation to kill you, really. The Beijing Social Insurance Agency basically put out a circular, and what is a circular is the subject of another podcast, but they put out a circular that basically said companies who want to payroll people from Beijing have to actually have a company presence in Beijing.
Other words, am I hearing you say that there are a bunch of employees that are claiming to be from Beijing, from in scare quotes, where they're not? Is that what you mean?
Yes. So there'd be somebody working in, somebody whose employer is a Shenzhen company and yet is payrolled out of Beijing.
So one thing that I learned about Beijing that is surprising to me hearing this is that it's meant to be where the emperor's son lives. And so I suppose the emperor's son shouldn't have to pay taxes, you know, certainly as much as every other schmo. But I'm surprised that Beijing would have some sort of favorable tax
So, actually, let me be clear. It's not a tax. It's not tax favorable. In fact, I mean, it's certainly not for employers. Generally, the contributions, social insurance contributions, et cetera, tend to be a little higher in Beijing, although that varies. But it's perks like letting your kids go to school there, getting sort of in-state tuition, maybe. The best example.
And that would make sense why the emperor's son location would matter, right? Your kids go to school.
Yeah. And I mean, that metaphor, I guess, has some, there's a bit of social status associated with getting payrolled out of Beijing too. But plenty of companies had payrolled people out of Beijing through just what they call a FESCO, which is a partially state-owned HR services provider. They could be a payroll provider. They could be a labor dispatch company. They could employ your employees, or they could just payroll them. So lots of companies without presence in Beijing would just use a FESCO, Beijing FESCO, to then payroll employees and not have an entity there. So what the circular did was basically shut that down for any company who was trying to payroll people through Beijing without a Beijing entity.
So most of our clients, of course, are doing this without even knowing it, right?
Yes. And that's the other thing. They wouldn't know it because it's so common that may have just been a negotiation on hire that wasn't even visible on any of the documents. So even if remote work appears to be fine, one day it may not be. So that's kind of another cautionary tale. It would take me years to describe that FESCO thing. So we'll just leave it at that. But if you want to pivot to the other China topic that we had.
So I have an interim topic before we get to the topic of China's new sexual harassment. And this is privacy in China. So one thing that I keep hearing about from our Asia-Pac experts, including you, Bonnie, is that China has very strict privacy laws. And of course, we all know, I mean, you can just read the newspaper to know that you don't have privacy in China, at least from the government standpoint. So, we've heard so much about the tracking, the tracking apps in COVID, where, you get some sort of a notification that says that you've been in the vicinity of people who've tested positive and you've got no idea how or why you've been followed in this particular way. There's this, common understanding that every single thing that goes out on the internet is monitored in one way or another. So how does privacy come about at all in relation to private employers, as opposed to what we're seeing and what we sort of take for granted about living in China?
You may think that's an interim topic, but it is actually very, very much related to our episode 10 podcast, which was on China's new sexual harassment law, which was actually part of China's civil code, which contained the privacy laws. So statement China has strict privacy laws is really in the eye of whoever the privacy laws are going to be wielded against. And the frustration that it has been the case in China largely is that private companies, especially foreign-owned companies, don't have any reasonable assurance how laws are going to be interpreted and enforced. And so privacy, interestingly, until this recent civil code, was actually also the subject of a, quote, circular. The China cybersecurity law, which did not really apply on point directly to employment data, is a couple of years old now. But in terms of, like, if you think of GDPR and those types of data privacy frameworks, mm-hmm. they didn't have an official one. They basically just had a circular that gave advisory guidelines without any enforcement provisions.
Okay, so now we have to have an interim topic, because you've said circular three times and we don't know what it is, or at least I don't. So please tell us.
So circular is a word that is a sort of blunt translation of a Chinese word that does not mean regulation, but it is often sort of interpreted when it's getting translated to headquarters, that is, English-speaking headquarters, as regulation. The reason that I prefer circular or notice or something, it's usually circular, is because what it means is it's basically like, heads up, you should start doing this because it's too complicated to really explain fully. I mean, you want to pay attention to circulars. And in the case of the recent circular that enforced the remote payroll piece, that was a circular, not so much because it wasn't the law, but because it wasn't new. It was a circular saying, yeah, you can't do this anymore. You never really could. But things are too squishy in terms of what is a law and how is it a law and where is it a law in China?
How is it going to be enforced and who's going to enforce it?
Yeah. Exactly, which is why the civil code, which is the subject of episode 10, which is focused on the harassment piece, but is really significant for other pieces too, why that's such a big deal, because they're codifying all of these kind of smorgasbord of laws in a way that you could theoretically enforce through private right of action. That's kind of the purpose, although it's not really clear how that's going to play out. But that's
so how that's does it connect deal. Privacy to sexual harassment? And then we do have to talk about what does sexual harassment mean in China, since it's been so long that we've not known.
Yes. Well, so the reason that they're tied together is because they're part of the first civil compilation of laws that covers a lot of everything, basically, including property rights. But for employers, those are the two main things that that I like to flag. In terms of what the civil code means for global employers. It's also kind of notable that this is happening. Such a big legal development is happening on the heels of this global pandemic, where a lot of the laws that are coming out are specifically pandemic related, and everything is framed in terms of the pandemic. And this is really, I mean, is this a signal that China is maybe thinking like back to business as usual? Mm-hmm. Ethan, do you have a thought on where the global, are we normalizing? Is anywhere back to normal?
So I think countries are definitely trying to get there. And I think we're seeing that a lot in how countries are responding to what I'll call the second wave. Although in some countries, it's not really a second wave. It's really just a first wave that they thought was over, but never really ended. So for example, I'll take Israel as a good example here, where basically they thought they had beat this thing. They were doing so well. They thought they were, kind of on top of how to deal with this. And then they got hit pretty hard, starting with some outbreaks in schools. And then they're like, well, we're not going to go back to locking down again the way we did the first time, and we'll see what happens. And it didn't work. And they're still in the midst of a very big outbreak in the country. They're doing pretty poorly in terms of controlling this new outbreak. And they've been trying to put in new ways of dealing with it that aren't going to lock down the country completely. So, like I said, countries are trying to normalize as much as they possibly can, while also recognizing that, hey, this pandemic is still there. We don't have a cure. We don't have a vaccine. We don't even know if a vaccine would work if we get one. So this thing is still here, but we're going to try and find some way to normalize society and some way to keep going. I mean, just today, the governor of New York said that indoor dining is coming back on September 30th up to 25% capacity, but with no real science to back up that it's safe, right? It seems almost like a random development in the law just because he's trying to normalize things.
So, yeah, I mean, so it's important. I mean, it's... The reason that we included all of that kind of China civil code as almost a little bit of a deviation from our standard global solutions motif was because China is taking steps in a direction that will affect employers, pandemic or not, and it's important to kind of see those trends in the context of where the world is trending generally, as the rest of the world may still be focusing largely on promulgating new pandemic related laws.
This is really important from what you're saying, Bonnie. You've done so many investigations in China, and you've already had to do them remotely. So now that the whole entire world who has to do investigations remotely is aware of this new set of laws, am I allowed to call it that? Laws/regulations in China that deal with sexual harassment, as well as with privacy. What do you envision for yourself when you're trying to conduct an investigation into a claim of sex harassment or into a claim of breach of a privacy issue or some combination of both? How are you going to be doing that differently from the way you were doing it before?
So here is an interesting tie-in back to COVID and back to what we're seeing in general. And the big tie is abuse of power. We are seeing globally at every level that there is a recognition of the power structures and kind of the way that they have tainted the workforce. But it's coming up in an interesting way in COVID. What's been happening is that for the first time, countries are really strict on their borders, and you might not be able to get in where you were before. And there are a lot of heads exploding over this because there are many things that you can get around, but government immigration restrictions, not in all cases, some people might not be able to go exactly where they want to go. And that is sort of a power position that's being adjusted with these border restrictions in some cases. And likewise, in the China sexual harassment law, actually specifically addresses abuse of power in a really notable way. There's this concept called guanxi in Chinese, another non-translatable term that is best understood conceptually as something like connections, networks, but it's a type of power as well. These networks that you have, if you have guanxi, like Ta Yu guanxi means, he has guanxi, so therefore the implication is, don't mess with that guy, don't mess with that woman. If they have connections, they get away with things like sexual harassment historically. And this new civil code specifically used the word guanxi, saying that people cannot abuse their guanxi to, they cannot use that to commit sexual harassment. So in terms of your question about how to do investigations differently based on this law, the answer is probably not much, but we can empower our clients in terms of conducting the investigation anyway. China is still a country in which, even with this new law, it's doesn't have enough enforcement details. Those are probably coming in a circular, right? But not a lot of enforcement details so that you can really what's going to happen if this goes to some sort of a prosecution. But you can empower employers kind of with the knowledge that there's been a strong policy statement on the books. And despite China's lifetime employment principle, if you need to get someone out for this, it's going to be more likely than before to be upheld.
All right, Ethan.
So Bonnie, you mentioned the border restrictions issue, and Carson, I know we've talked about some of the border restrictions in Italy and how those are affecting some of our clients. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, not really, just because everybody's so miserable by it. And so the idea is that we all know that folks from the U.S. are banned from traveling to the EU. And we also have learned that there are certain exceptions to that. And in Italy, one of the exceptions is if you are traveling for business purposes. And if you are, then you, assuming that you can get into the country, then you must quarantine for 14 days. In Sweden, I learned today that there is not a quarantine requirement, but if you're traveling for business purposes, it has to be for an essential or critical business purpose. And that is the full extent of the legal authority that we have. There are so many interesting stories about people who get turned away at the airport in the US, people who get turned away by border control in the EU, either in Italy or in Sweden, in my examples, or who make it through. And there's really no rhyme or reason. So one thing that we've been trying to do is just help clients assemble an entire dossier full of documents to prove that the folks that they're sending to the EU are there for legitimate business reasons and that they'll meet the requirements. If there's any little nugget of helpful information that I can provide out of this, there's actually two. One is print out the requirements from the website that are available to anyone online. And that is because people in airports who can have the authority to turn you away, even if it's just a ticket agent, or folks at the border have very outdated information. And so a whole lot of what we're hearing and seeing is folks that are using old circulars, sorry to use your China word, Bonnie, for purposes of turning people away. And if you can just print out your little web page that says that these are the criteria to get in, that is helpful. The other thing is spend the money to find the VIP part of the airport. Especially in Europe, there are so many very sort of only known to locals secret VIP entry ports that you can find where you spend more money and you get a concierge that will pick you up literally as you walk out the door of the airplane and walk right through. And so as much as everybody feels disgusted about having to spend extra money on travel, if there's really a reason to be sending folks over to Europe right now, it is probably worth the VIP treatment.
Ethan, didn't you at one point say that Italy was kind of opening more for tourists? Has that gone away now?
So it wasn't that it was opening more for tourists. It's more that they were encouraging tourism within Italy. And, you know, they were kind of encouraging Italians to take vacation and providing stipends for that, as well as providing some stimulus packages for hotels and the hospitality industry. And that's really what I was talking about on tourism in Italy.
Yeah. So what's interesting, so the other kind of country that keeps coming up in these border discussions is the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. And that has been a very, it's been kind of a crazy location for business travelers and employees. Because
yeah, what's up with the UAE?
I don't know because I haven't checked it in a couple of days, but I will tell you that at least at one point there was a point in time where you could not get over on a business visitor visa basically under any circumstances, but you could get over on a tourist visa. That's of course a difficult conundrum for employers who would like to send their employees on business travel. And I tend to say, don't mess with it too much in the UAE. They tend to be a little bit more aggressive with their immigration enforcement, and the consequences and the stakes are extremely high there. But it's a very interesting jurisdiction because they have kind of made a play for international tourism while kind of cracking down on business travel and overstay if you are there on a work permit.
So another thing that's kind of been coming up in the tourist industry is basically how do you keep tourists safe, right? And I think one of the funny anecdotes that I've come across throughout, you know, looking at all these different countries and what they're doing for tourism is actually going back to Italy, where in the Duomo in Florence, they were actually providing each visitor to the Duomo with what they called a social distancing necklace. And basically it was just a device hanging on one of those lanyards that would buzz if it got within 2 meters of another device within.
I am so excited to see this come into the United States, actually.
So what's interesting from an employment law perspective of this is that employers have gotten very creative on this to protect customers, to protect employees, to get back to business, and are coming up with ideas such as, the social distancing necklace, but usually in the form of policies and procedures that they often kind of get their news where they get their news. They get their public health information from a variety of sources, and then they themselves kind of distill it into a policy. And I've seen some really, really creative ideas, but I tend to suggest that employers source their social distancing practices in other public health guidance or get it vetted with a medical or epidemiological provider. So it's great to get creative with social distancing, but public health authority guidance is really where employers should probably stick to.
I do think, though, to pick up on your serious tone, Bonnie, that because, you know, it kind of comes back to what I was trying to say before, where since every country and every jurisdiction's laws are so very different, companies are just going to have to come up with their own policies and practices to handle things uniformly, or just leave it up to their local folks to figure it out themselves. And I think no organization, on the global scale really feels comfortable doing that because they're leaving people in the lurch, so to speak. And so this is just one other way where, you know, we know we're going to be bringing people back to work, but we don't know how we're going to comply with every single possible regulation, circular, or law that's out there. So we're just going to have to figure something out that's going to work generally and see if we can apply it across the board.
You need to have some level of global solution, as it were, to this, to the return to work notion. And one way in which companies are trying to reconcile this is to look for and synthesize industry guidance specific to their industry, because in many different locations they have issued industry specific guidance, and in some countries they have industry specific collective bargaining agreements, those kinds of things that will also guide the analysis and may help to kind of provide a common ground among various countries in terms of an approach. And Adolfo and Katie have discussed that. Adolfo is a law clerk in our Stanford office, and Katie is an associate in our Atlanta office. And they've also discussed that on one of our recent podcasts. They've given some insight into the industry guidance.
Yeah, and another area where I think, you know, companies need to kind of figure out what they want to do is the idea of what's going to happen if schools close again. I know no one wants to talk about that because it's scary to many parents. But as Chris and Enrique spoke about on a recent podcast as well, the school issue is a big one, and it's a big one for both employers and employees. And, you know, we're seeing already, even with schools just reopening in the past week or 2 weeks, we're already seeing cases where, you know, a kid is sick at home with not even really a fever, just, you know, a little bit elevated fever, has a cough and a sore throat, turns out to be strep. But, you know, the parents sent their other three kids to school the teachers ask, okay, where's your sibling? They say he's sick. Those three kids get sent home from school. So, you know, these are situations where, you know, the parents then have to figure out care for these children and figure out what's going on.
So are you literally talking about my daughter's situation that I told you about last week, or?
I am not.
I mean, that's just the thing, though, is that, you know, for you parents that have been dealing with the fact that schools can randomly close and declare days off without any notice whatsoever for as long as you can remember, this is the same thing, only so much worse. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's really any place in the world that I can think of, maybe in China, maybe in Korea, where schools have reopened and anyone can rely on that with some sort of certainty. Have you?
Yeah, it's so unreliable. I know that there have been, you know, places around the world that are, you know, they've had the schools open, they've shut them down again, they've opened them up again. You know, it's such a fluid situation that it's really hard to predict really anything. And I've actually heard locally of some schools here in New Jersey that, you know, some schools are thinking that they're going to be open for the whole year. And then there are other schools that are spending the first few weeks of school training the kids on the online platforms because they expect to go remote again. So, you know, these are just some of the things that are happening, and employers really need to take these into account when they're thinking about leave policies or about COVID-related leaves. You know, there's the FFCRA leaves, things like that. So there are a lot of considerations that go into this that really, it's a very uncertain time.
And so what's interesting about that, that comment, so this, the leaves and the school closures are addressed on episodes 9 and 11. And what's interesting is that I kind of thought along the similar lines that we, you know, you can't really necessarily rely on schools staying open, et cetera, et cetera, anywhere in the world. And then when we were preparing our companion content, just a quick reference on as of that date, what schools were doing, we did find that a lot of schools were just open. And I don't know whether that reflects, you know, a local priority to say, hey, we're going to close everything else before schools, or whether it just reflects how the three of us are sitting in the U.S. and are surrounded by a situation where that is definitely true here in terms of the schools not being open. But if you refer to that chart, there are many places where schools are open. But to Ethan's point, most of them have very strict protocols in place that would then require quarantine and, you know, what's an exposure. All of these things are going to still lead to employees in many parts of the world without childcare because of these quarantine situations, even if the school's open.
Yeah, that's a good point, Bonnie, because you could very easily have a situation, and I think a lot of people don't even think about this because they're just excited that the kids are back in school, but you could very easily have a situation where you have one child who gets sick, has COVID, or even is just displaying COVID symptoms, and they have to send that child, that child's class, that child's siblings, maybe even the child's siblings' classes home. You may even be talking about 20 to 30% of a school getting sent home just from one child. And you know, these are the kind of things that it may depend on local law, on local procedure, even on just the school itself and what the procedures are there. So it's a very fluid situation and definitely something to keep our eye on.
Yeah. So what happened with my daughter's school is we go to a private school that has has very specific protocols, but as employers and schools, and we're all sort of trying to figure this out as we go along, knowing what we know from the public health authorities at the time. So what's interesting is that they have a rule that if you're pending COVID test results, that you have to stay home. So we got, by the way, the the idea of house calls has come back into vogue, in addition to telemedicine, both of which are extremely good developments from the perspective of a parent of small children. So my kid and one of her carpool mates both wound up with a couple of symptoms, and I got one of the house call services to come to the house, and the house call service gave a strep test first, and it was strep. And, you know, it was obviously strep, but I, not thinking about this rule, said, well, since you're here, why don't we do a COVID test? Because for a couple of reasons, just, you know, also because I wanted to get my daughter sort of socialized to it. She's six. And also because, hey, you know, it's nice to, since this is an asymptomatic illness, you know, it's nice to have a negative result to sort of check in with that. And then, since it was strep though, and I had a doctor's note to send her back to school, I sent her back to school, and then she started bragging to her friends about having taken a COVID test. And the nurse calls me and is like, did you guys take a COVID test? And I'm like, okay, whoops. They didn't send us home, but it's just interesting how these situations can play out with kids.
Yeah, and the situation I was describing earlier, which wasn't your daughter, it was a similar situation where the child had strep. That's what they had, and similar to your daughter, but not the same case. And again, trying to be cautious and trying to actually do the right thing, the child's father had them tested, and because of that, that's really why he and his siblings then couldn't go back to school.
Wow,
for a couple of days, actually, because it's pretty much the same thing. I'm not referring to your daughter, but it's a similar situation. And I spoke with the father of this child, and he said to me, this really discourages people from getting.
Yes, it's all about the incentives and employers, to bring that back. When creating these policies, think hard about the incentives that they're creating, because there is, back when we were debating temp checks, that seems to be very, very normal at this point in most places, not all places. But, thinking about if people are going to have to go on unpaid leave, and, if you're giving them the incentive to beat a temp check, they could probably beat it if that's all that there is. So with this incentive piece, and that's a very useful kind of insight for employers, because, if it happened to almost identically between, Ethan's contact and me, probably is happening to some of our clients' employees too.
Yeah, you can beat a temp check by sitting in a car with air conditioning for a while. I mean, that's not, it's really not that difficult. And it's one of those things where I think, Dr. Fauci mentioned that temp checks don't actually do very much. And he's not wrong.
Yeah. So, it's got to think in terms of your return to work. So to Carson's point about trying to come up with global guidelines, you have to think really strongly about the incentives it will create in the employees and the trust that you're developing with the employees. I was hoping that before we brought up the school recap from Chris and Enrique's podcast, my kids would have busted in the door, because they are expected to do so shortly, and that we would have I would have been able to get them to podcast bomb, but they haven't. So let's move on. The school closures is and having to deal with kids at home. And also working from home is an interesting topic. Dealing with that and employers wishing to cut costs, one of the ways that they may cut costs is by going remote and not having to have and run an office. Another method of cutting costs is thinking about restructuring or reducing headcount. And that brings us, let's bring it home with Carson, who podcasted on this topic in episode 7. This was several weeks ago, so there may have been changes. We have another related podcast coming out soon with Ryan and Justin talking about the end of some subsidies that are expiring. But Carson, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the topic of redundancies in the time of COVID and 5 to 6 weeks later?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the issues is that several companies have decided to use the various furlough options that are available through government programs. So a furlough in the U.S., we all mean an unpaid leave of absence that is for at least a temporary period, if not a specified limited duration. And several countries, including the UK, including Canada, even the US to a certain degree, allowed various organizations to send their employees on furlough where the employees would be able to collect some kind of benefit or subsidy, either through unemployment or through the ordinary payroll process. And the expectation, I think, was that it was meant to be finished by October 1st. Now that we're here, we're seeing some countries extend that period of time and some go with the original kind of winding down process. So Canada just very recently extended it. I think that was earlier this week. And the UK is going forward with its winding down process. The companies that have sent these folks out on furlough are realizing that they still do not have work for them to do. So they have to take the unfortunate decision to move forward with redundancies and terminations. And it's a very tough decision to make because they know they've been, having folks out on pins and needles for quite a long time. And now they need to set them loose. Several other companies have decided to take furloughs for the sort of unfortunate reason of needing to conserve cash flow. A redundancy or a layoff, as we would think of it, often carries very, very expensive severance obligations as a result, all of which were delayed or somehow avoided through the furlough process. And now these same organizations are having to bite the bullet. It's a really sad set of circumstances and no one's happy about it. There is a general understanding, I suppose, fortunately, that the COVID crisis has caused a real economic loss to many, many global organizations. So at least there's a common understanding about why it's happening, but it's a fairly dismal issue. One of the other things that came up through last week's podcast about the various leave of absence that are out there is that in most countries outside of the US, if you are on a job protected leave of absence, like a medical leave, then you're protected from termination. It's different than what we think of as being as having a job protected leave of absence. When you're protected from termination, it means you absolutely cannot be terminated, or if you are, you're going to be reinstated. So I would just make sure to caution folks to make sure that if they are going through layoffs, especially if they're going through large global layoffs, to double check that the folks that are on the list are not also out on some kind of a job protected leave, like a sick leave or a quarantine.
For China, you're protected until a year after a baby is born. So if you have anyone, not just if they're on maternity leave, but if they are in what is called in China, I always struggle with saying this word, describing it this way in English, because it's not totally accurate, but lactation leave, basically that's up to, it's not necessarily exactly when someone is nursing, because it's not, it's not limited to people who nurse for or pump for a year, nor is it extended if someone pumps longer than that. But it is a year after the baby is born, no termination, basically. So in reality, it gets negotiated out, but for a lot of companies, usually until the end of, it can be up to the end of that that lactation period after the baby is born. So 1 year after the baby is born. So job protected leaves are key in terms of implementing this. One thing, Carson, on your podcast that was really interesting was when Andre was talking about Germany. In Germany, you can sort of choose, is this temporary or is this not temporary? If it's temporary, you can't terminate. You have to, you know, do the short time work or furlough. Mm-hmm. But if it is permanent, then you can't get the short time working. So you have to kind of make a choice up front. And I thought that was interesting. And I haven't, how does that shake out? Is that the same thing in other jurisdictions? Because what you just described seems like the case that you would see, like maybe we thought it was temporary, but how long is temporary? And what's that mean? I mean, I think Germany just extended their subsidy until the end of next year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, many of the European countries did the same thing where they put together a program that said, send these people out on leave. We will help you subsidize their paycheck. And you just have to promise not to terminate them after their leave is over. So that is absolutely the case in Germany. It's the same in Spain, for example. There are some countries that have set periods of time and others that are more open-ended. But then there are others like the UK that kind of recognized right from the front that this was an interim measure. So, you know, if an organization went through the very intricate process of trying to figure out each country's various furlough programs, there will be some job protection for some of those folks if they are out on an unpaid leave or a partially subsidized leave. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I mean, what I guess we don't know, and we will maybe eventually know, is whether that sort of decision point comes back to bite employers. Like if employers made the decision, like say to call this a temporary thing and go to short time work, but mid 2021, before the subsidy is up, they realize we don't have any projections that this is going to be temporary anymore. Would the fact that they use short time work actually cut the other way? I mean, I think that one thing that is, and that we are going to cover, in a future podcast, is litigation. What litigations are we going to see?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when often outside the U.S., it's not in within the U.S. A lot of the litigation you see, you're going to see maybe workplace safety enforcement, you know, that kind of thing. And we have another podcast series at Ogletree that covers that a lot. That we're actually co-podcasting with them in a few weeks on that. But what's interesting outside of the U.S. Is that the drivers of litigation is usually unfair dismissal, whereas in the U.S. it's at will. So our litigation challenges to dismissals are discrimination, retaliation, we have wage hour, but dismissal suits, how do you think COVID is going to shape that?
On dismissal suits, I think that it's going to be more difficult for employees than it was before, frankly. I think that there is a more universal recognized understanding that this is a global economic crisis that's not made up by any particular company, and that a company's losses, especially in instances where they've taken steps to try to avoid terminations and can demonstrate that a company's losses are not going to be questioned in the same way that we've seen in the past. That's my two cents on it.
Yeah. So you think that we might actually get some better case law than in the past on what constitutes a genuine redundancy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. I do. And I also think that in countries where there are these very strict limitations on terminations, there will still be some way of negotiating around it. So, you know, lawyers always find a way to earn a living, and lawyers will always figure out a way to carry forward with the negotiations if that's what's necessary. And so we'll see a bit of that as well.
All right. Well, Ethan, how about you wrap it up? What did we miss in terms of recapping?
Well, I think the big one we didn't talk about is COVID testing as a workplace strategy, right? You know, what I've seen is there have been a lot of, I've seen a few clients come to us and ask, okay, can I require a COVID test after my employee comes back from a X country? Can I require a COVID test if my employee just goes on a domestic vacation but got on an airplane, right? So these are the kind of the questions that we've been seeing on this. And the truth is, it so varies from country to country because we don't really know, but we've seen there's no real trend on, you know, these countries say you can do a COVID test, these countries say you can't. There's not really a trend on that. And then comes the question of, is the COVID test available? And if it's available, when are you getting your results? And if you're not getting your results for 2 weeks, what are you doing with that employee for 2 weeks? So these are kind of the questions that kind of roll off of that COVID testing policy. And it's something that's still developing and we're keeping an eye on.
Yeah, I think that here's the podcast bombing children. Here they are. Anyway, so the COVID testing trend, if any, is really based on data privacy, I would say, is that if there's in Europe, and Carson, if you have stuff to add to this, because I know you've been dealing with some, health screen type things, there's the data privacy regulators there have sometimes taken a really hard stance that you can't do that. You can't condition, you can't make someone take a test. What we are seeing, interestingly, is that some clients are actually the ones to require the COVID test or require the somewhat invasive screening. And then the employer who is the one with employment obligations to its own employees is struggling on what to do because they don't want to force the employees to go through this.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea of just testing in general, I think, is a pretty frightening prospect just simply because so many of these companies are not in the business of figuring out how to do testing or what to do with testing information. The whole thing gives me the willies. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's kind of crazy to think that your employer can say, okay, go get tested or you can't come to work, right? That's, to me, that seems crazy. I guess doing a temperature check and filling out a form stating that I don't have any symptoms is just as, invasive, I guess. Although it's not actually doing a swab or anything like that. But to me, it's just a little crazy to require that kind of invasive testing as a condition of coming to work or as just because, a customer requested it or the like.
So clearly you belong in Europe, right, Carson?
Right. I mean, of course, from the privacy perspective, Europe is very, very determined on how it's going to address these types of issues. And there is really no option for administering some kind of a temperature check or medical exam in some European countries in Central Europe, the Netherlands is what I'm thinking of in particular, without involving the company's doctor that the company pays for. And so then we kind of cascade down from there to figure out what sorts of disclosures are we going to require and how are we going to double check to make sure that they're accurate. In the end, though, what I'm seeing on a global scale is companies are asking people if they somehow trigger the very, very well-known and well-publicized by the WHO and by the CDC guidelines, one of the red flags from those various guidelines. And if so, they're saying, don't come into the office, but they're not trying to track the information or keep it. And yet they all recognize, and I'm sure on the Asia Pac side, Bonnie, you see this a lot more, that there are certain benefits that are available to employees if they get the virus or if they test positive at work, right?
Yeah. We had one instance in Japan where, and I think somebody may have already podcasted about this, but where somebody lied, an employee lied and said that the local government was requiring everybody to go get contacted him to get a random COVID test and blew off work for it. So, you know, hey, some employees are going to find a way to kind of use pandemics to hoodwink their employers. So here's my podcast bombing daughter. Hey, I told your story about how you got a strep test. Do you want to say hi? Oh, of course, now you're quiet. Say hi. All right. Well, with that, let's see. What do we got coming up, Ethan?
So we have a couple of podcasts coming up. As you mentioned, there's the podcast about kind of the industry sectors. And those ones coming up, we have the podcast about internal rules and policies, setting those for COVID-based things. And we have the co-podcast with our COVID litigation group, which should be really interesting to listen to.
Great. So let's wrap up. Let's have everybody, if you have one sentence to say to employers based on our last 12 podcasts. What's your one takeaway?
I think my takeaway is just to be kind of forward-looking and fluid at the same time, right? We have to create policies that are going to address the myriad number of issues that are coming up on a daily basis because of this pandemic. But at the same time, like I said, they're coming up daily and they're changing daily. And that's something that I think we need to be both, you know, I guess, have rigid policies, but be fluid about how we apply them because we need to take into account that this is not a normal situation.
My takeaway is think really hard before opening an entity in a different country for a single employee who wants to live there for personal reasons.
That's a good one.
And with that, I think that we have concluded our second recap. Until next time, I hope that everyone is navigating the pandemic well, and see you next time on Global Solutions.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.